Right, Genesis 48. So Jacob and his whole household, they've moved to the land of Egypt, and the provision of God was through Joseph. Everything was through God who did it. And Pharaoh, we read last time, he gave them the best of the land. He gave them the whole part of Goshen that was like by the Nile Delta to dwell in. And guess what? They prospered because God was for them. And so God gave Jacob, we read, another 17 years with Joseph, with his favorite son. And so he was 147 years old, we read last time. And today we want to just take note of the blessing of Jacob. And the first chapter we're going to look at, chapter 48, is Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. And so verse 1 there, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim." So now he's very old, and now you get the news that he's sick. So now you are sort of, you know, the time is short, the time is near. And he took his two sons to go see him. "And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you,' and Israel strengthened himself and he sat up on the bed." So you can imagine, he used like all the last strength he had. He sat up straight in the bed that he was in. He was sick, and when he heard his son is coming, he's like, "No, I got to sit up for this." "Then Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me.'" So this is amazing. Luz is in the area of Bethel. So don't be confused about that, because we know he met the Lord in Bethel. It's just another name for Bethel in Genesis 28, 19 and Genesis 35, verse 6. It's where Jacob first met God. And see, you know, even at this point in his life, just before he's right at the end of his life, and that memory is fresh in his mind, like when God met him at Bethel. You know, it was a vivid reminder, and he's just excited about it. And it's like the first thing he starts speaking about, like, "When God met me," you know, it was a great moment for him. And then he says in verse 4, "And he said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a multitude of people. And I give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession.'" So God repeated now his covenant to Abram, to Isaac, to Jacob. But guess what? God never spoke to any of the sons. These were the patriarchs, the three patriarchs. But God never spoke to any one of Joseph's sons like he spoke to the first three patriarchs about this covenant, about this promise. Joseph now hears it from his father. He doesn't hear it directly from God. And so now his father tells him about the promise that God made. And he gives him the exact promises. So his phrasing and his wording is sort of important, because it's representing God and what God said in Genesis chapter 17. He says, "And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine." So it's like, you know, your two sons, I'm claiming them for myself. I'm taking them. It's not as bad as it sounds, because basically it's a blessing. It's a great blessing, because he says they'll be like Reuben and Simeon, the oldest two sons that he had. It's like, those were my two oldest sons who's supposed to get the big blessing. He's like, they'll be like them. They'll be like the two oldest sons. So it was customary, obviously, that the oldest son received double portion of the inheritance than all any of the other brothers. That was the customary thing. But the two oldest ones, we know they were disqualified. Actually, the three oldest sons were disqualified. They disqualified themselves from positions of status and leadership in Israel's family because of their sin in Genesis 34 and 35. And so now Joseph gets the double portion, in the sense that he gets the blessing in both of his sons. So Joseph would have been one tribe, now he becomes two. So he really gets a double portion as the blessing. They will become two of the tribes and they will inherit the land. So in reality, you know, we see there's actually 13 tribes in Israel. But 12 is obviously the symbolic number of human government. We see so many things in scripture that has the number 12. There's 12 apostles. They speak about the 12 tribes, the 12 sons, because it speaks about human government. But in actual fact, there was 13. And then verse 6, it says, "Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance." And so you can get the rest that will come later, but these two I'm taking for myself. They will be like as my own sons, pretty much. "But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way. When there was a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So the other thing that is still fresh in his mind, a sad remembrance, is Israel remembered a tragic death of his beloved wife Rachel at the birth of their son Benjamin in Genesis 35, verse 16 to 18. This is still on his heart. This is what he speaks about at this last moments in his life. It's important to him. And then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" So before you think like, what's going on here? It's like, hasn't he seen them before? He's going blind. We're going to see just now. His eyes are really bad. And so he wants to start giving out some blessings. So he's just double checking. Like, these two sort of figures I see here are these who I think they are. You know, so who are these? And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me and I will bless them." Amazing, because he's going blind, but now the first thing he speaks about is the fact that God has blessed him. And now at this point, he does what I think is such an important thing. He wants to carry over that blessing. He wants to take the blessing of God that God has given him, and he wants to give it to the sons, to those who are going to follow in that line. So bring them here. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has also shown me your offspring." So this is also cool because, yes, it's a picture of grace. It's a picture of who the God is that we serve, right? Because God always has better than our best. He thought like, you know, I would never even see Joseph again. And not only did he see him, but now he sees his sons. And what a blessing. It reminds us of Ephesians 3:20, where God says, "Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all we ask or think, according to the power that works in us." So God is one that blesses exceedingly above and beyond. I mean, you can't put it in a better way. Exceedingly above and beyond. That's who God is. And so he's basically saying that, you know, God has shown me grace because I've seen your offspring. So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. So now he's bowing down in reverence and respect for his father. I mean, he's the leader in many ways of the country. He's the one who delivered them all. He's a very important guy, but before his father, he bows down in reverence and respect for his father that he loved so much. Verse 13. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. So now he's bringing them close because he knows how it works. Everyone, you know, in those days, specifically in Israel, they knew how it works. As the father's going to bless, the right hand is the important. So he brings them that the oldest one would be, Manasseh would be by his right hand and Ephraim would be by his left hand. So as they approach his father, he's like, he brings them forward like that, you know, like he knows the way that it's supposed to work. Verse 14, and Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. So something interesting now. As he brings him closer, he does this. He crosses his arms. You know, he puts his right hand on the younger and he puts his left hand on the older. And so this is not the way that it's normally done. So, and it says he guiding his hands knowingly because he knew exactly what he's doing. He was not just an old blind man. He was like, oh, you know, maybe he brought them to me wrong, whatever. So he knew exactly what he's been doing because the right hand, like I said, is the favorite hand in the ancient world. The right hand is the hand of strength and of skill. It is an important hand. So in that sense, it's almost like there's more blessing coming out of the right hand, you know, than the left hand. So it's very important to have the right hand on the right place. Verse 15, and he blessed Joseph. Isn't that cool? So that's what he says. He blessed Joseph because he's blessing his sons. And he said, "God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." So first of all, he mentions three times really God there. The first one, he says, God before whom my fathers walked. He's really speaking about God the Father here. Because Israel granted the blessing in a deep awareness of the covenant that came from God's promise to his fathers. He was very much aware that he is part of this line and that he has to pass this on. Then he said, God who has fed me all my life. Literally means the God who has shepherded me all my life. And that's a picture of the Holy Spirit being led, you know, by the Spirit of God. And then, you know, it's really a testimony of grace because he didn't at any point say how faithful he was to God. He's speaking about how faithful God was to him. That's the picture of grace. That's what we can all testify of. And then in verse 16, he says, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. That speaks about Jesus Christ, the Redeemer. And he says, then let them grow into a multitude. So he really blessed them in faith because this kind of blessing, he won't see it. What is faith? Faith is a substance of things that you cannot see. So he's blessing them for the future in something that he cannot see, and he's become a man of faith. He's mentioned in the great chapter of faith in the Bible, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 21. It says, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. So here we get a bit deeper information in the New Testament of what's going. Because God's plan never ends with the death of a man. Isn't that amazing? God's not like, okay, there goes Jacob, so now my plan stops. No, God's plan is going to continue, and that's why he blesses them. Verse 17. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, he displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. So Joseph, I don't know if he's like sort of peeking up or what he's doing, but he sees his father's arms are crossed. And he's like, no, that's not right. Shouldn't be like that. Because he specifically put the right son at the right hand. And he's like, no, it shouldn't work like that, you know. And so he tries to stop him. He actually puts his hand on his father's hand to try and move it back to where it was. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. So sort of trying to correct his almost blind father, because maybe he was just thinking, dad is so blind, he doesn't know what he's doing. But meantime, he knew exactly what he's doing. And he said to him in verse 19, his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So first of all, he says, I know. You know, I know exactly what I'm doing. This is not a mistake. It's not because I'm old and blind. I'm doing this for a very specific reason. And he says, he shall also become a people, but his younger brother shall be greater. So Ephraim wasn't the firstborn, but guess what? God chose to make him, put him in the position of the firstborn. And we've seen this many times before. We read about it in Jeremiah 31, verse 9. It says, I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. So here we see that even from God's perspective, this is how he saw it. And so here, Jacob was just going by the command of God. And this shows how the idea of the firstborn in the Bible is the position of preeminence. It's not necessarily the first one who came out of the womb. Speaking about Jesus, the firstborn, again, it's the same picture. He's got the preeminence. It's not like necessarily the first one who was born from the womb. And so that's very important. And then he says in verse 20, so he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he said Ephraim before Manasseh. So it wasn't him. It was through just being obedient to what God had told him to. And we know the same thing happened with his own life, really. You know, the younger became the one that the blessing will go through. And so the name Ephraim was later used to reflect the whole nation of the northern part of Israel. Like in Isaiah chapter 7, he speaks about that a number of times. He just speaks about Ephraim, but he really speaks about the whole northern part of the nation of Israel. And so he said Ephraim before Manasseh. And then he said to Joseph, Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. So I'll be speaking about the land of Canaan, the promised land. And so here we see Israel, the last of the patriarchs. After this, there's no more patriarchs of the Jews. But look at those words. I think it's very important words. He says, I am dying, but God. That is super important. What an amazing truth. He's like, yes, I'm the last of the patriarchs. I'm going. But guess what? Someone infinitely greater is with you. I'm not there anymore. I'm going to be gone. And so the patriarchs are going to end right here, but God. But God is still in control of everything. And the thing is, as long as God is with you, you'll be okay, because God knows that. God's the one who stirs all these things, that moves all these things. Moreover, I've given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. So somehow, you know, he acquired a piece of land that he took from the Amorites. And so this will only realize like 400 years later, when they would conquer the land, they would go back and take the possession of the promised land. So it will be a long time later that these things will come to pass. But it shows you the importance of walking in God's will, knowing God's will, and then he's really speaking prophetically here. So chapter 49, where Jacob now blesses his own sons, and it says in verse 1 there, "And Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." And so this is not really, strictly speaking, a blessing as much as it is a prophecy. He's really prophesying about the truth. He's telling them what's going to become of their future. Because we talked about this before, his life has been hard. But even in his whole life, this is probably his finest hour, right here at his deathbed, because he's doing something amazing here. He ends well. And I always say that's the important part. You know, anyone can start well, but the thing is to end well. So I think it's quite cool that at Jacob's last moments in his life, his finest hour is his last moments in his life. He acts as a complete man of faith. He's speaking blessing on the future. He's prophesying about what's going to happen to his sons. And all of this is done absolutely as a man of faith. And so it's a prophecy regarding what God will do with him in the future. But the thing is, even a warning is a blessing when it comes from God, isn't it? God can use many things. We can hear things like a warning or a encouragement or whatever. We're like, ah, you know, like you just shared now. I think God can use anything that for good if it comes from him. So verse 2, he says, "Gather together and hear you sons of Jacob and listen to Israel your father." And now as he speaks, like I say, he's speaking from a place of spiritual maturity. Because think of it. Look at what he says there. He says, "Gather together, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." So now at this point, he is very much aware that he was both in his life, Jacob and Israel. There were times when he was Jacob, and there were times when he was Israel. And this takes a lot of maturity to see yourself, not just the things that go well in the spirit, but you see the things that is wrong also. Because Jacob was all the things that he tried to fight against. You know, that's like Paul says, I beat my body, you know. I try to bring it in subjection. The things that I want to do, I don't do. And the things that I don't do, I want to do, kind of thing. And so, and Israel, on the other hand, that's what God made him. This is the work that God was doing in him. And therefore, all these sons that he had, some of them were like Jacob, and some of them were more like Israel. And so now as he speaks from this absolute place of maturity, and he's going to prophesy over their lives. And he starts with his firstborn. He says, "Reuben," verse 3, "you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellence of power." So Reuben was the firstborn, and he should have gotten the first blessing, the double portion, the biggest blessing. But, I mean, you can just imagine as he starts speaking, you're like the excellence of dignity and power. You can imagine it's like, yo, you know, standing all upright and, you know, and that. And it's like, because this is where everything of him, all his descendants started with Reuben. He was the beginning of it all. It's like the procreation process, you know. And then verse 4, he says, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." And so God looks for character in people who will lead. God looks for a character that's much deeper than the things that just the obvious things on the outside. And so think about none of the tribe of Reuben were ever excelled. Reuben, think about them as they came into the promised land. They didn't really come into the promised land. They inherited on the other side of the Jordan. So they didn't even, the property they got, the land they got was on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't even move over the Jordan into what God saw as the promised land. And so Reuben is an example of how the first can be last, as Matthew 19 verse 30 says. Jesus said, you know, many that are first will be last, and many that are last will be first. So this is a great example. He says, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. So he allowed his lust to run wild, and so Reuben would be a disappointing people because he paid a high price for his instability. The next one there, verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. So now he gets to the next two that were supposed to be in line. We always see Simeon and Levi together. They're like the twin brothers of, I don't know, destruction. You know, they were together, but their unity wasn't a good thing. They were always together, but it was a bad combination. They were instruments of cruelty when they wiped out all the men of Shechem in their retaliation for the rape of their sister Dinah in Genesis 34, verse 25 to 29. So they had a common bond, but their common bond was bad because there was anger and violence involved in that. And he's like, let not my soul enter their council, for in their anger they slew a man, their self-will. And the thing is, that's where all bad stuff comes from, is self-will. This is what I want. You know, where God tries to take us from that place of self-will into, God, I don't want self anymore. I want whatever you want, God. And so this is where all their anger, all their problems come from, was from their self-will. And then he says there in verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So Simeon was by far the weakest numerically. If you read Numbers chapter 26, you'll see that they were the smallest tribe, really. And so Simeon and Levi were both, if you want to look at them as a people, they were dispersed people because they were dispersed among the other tribes, really. You think about Simeon, he was very small, sort of like almost insignificant. And Levi on the other side, remember, he was blessed in his dispersion, though, because he was broken up into all the tribes because they were the priestly tribe. And so they were given not specific land, but they were broken up into all the tribes to be priests for all the tribes, the tribe of Levi. So they were dispersed people, broken up and dispersed in different ways, but still dispersed. Then verse 8, Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Well, Judah means praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. And so Judah means praise. And the couple of things we see about Judah, because we all know who Judah stands for, because that's the tribe that the Messiah would eventually come from. And so, first of all, he speaks of Judah as a leader. You are the one that your brothers shall praise, because he was the one who spoke on behalf of their brothers. Think about even when Reuben spoke in the beginning, when they put Joseph in the hole, in the pit. Then Judah came and was like, no, let's sell him, you know. It wasn't a good decision, but he was the one speaking for his brothers. Later, he was the one who offered himself, like, I'll be a slave rather than Benjamin. So he was the one who stood up. He was the one who took the lead. And all his brothers followed him. They listened to him. And so first of all, Judah is a leader. And he says, your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow before you. That means there's a preeminence that Judah gets here above the other brothers. He says in verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who shall rouse him. So now we know, secondly, Judah is a lion. And we know he's the lion of the tribe of Judah, really what's going to come from him. Revelation chapter 5 verse 5 speaks that about Jesus Christ. Then verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. So this speaks of him, you know, it really speaks of him as a king, but this is the prophecy. This is the prophecy about the Messiah. This verse that you read right here in the book of Genesis, spoken by Jacob, the last patriarch, speaks prophetically of the future where Jesus Christ, the Messiah, will come. It says, until Shiloh comes. So this prophecy is fulfilled because it speaks of Messiah, because Shiloh is a different form of the Hebrew word shalom. So it speaks of peace, until peace comes. Because Shiloh did come, firstly, partially. We know all prophecy really in Scripture has a partial fulfillment, and then it's got a complete ultimate fulfillment. And so the partial fulfillment was 640 years, you know, after this, in the reign of David, Israel had peace in that first dynasty of the kings. But the prophecy, the real fulfillment of the prophecy, 1,600 years later, to be completely fulfilled in Jesus Christ as the Prince of Peace. Because think about when Jesus rode into Jerusalem, that day when he was approaching the city in Luke 19, verse 41 and 42. It says, as he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, especially in this, your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. So Jesus came in as Shiloh, as the Messiah. He was bringing peace, but they didn't see it. And so 40 years after Jesus was crucified, guess what? The scepter departed from Judah. It fell to Rome. There was no chance anymore. 40 years after Jesus was crucified, there was no chance that anyone could ever stand up again and say, I'm the Messiah. Because this part of the prophecy can never happen anymore. The scepter failed, departed from Judah. And at that stage, because they didn't believe in Jesus Christ as the Messiah, many of them tore their clothes and they ripped their robes. And they said, because God's word has failed, Messiah hasn't shown up. And now the scepter has departed from Judah. And so we know it didn't. In actual fact, Jesus Christ is the Messiah. And to him shall be the obedience of his people. So that's the third thing that speaks about Judah, as he will be Lord. He will be the one ruling and reigning. We see there in verse 11, it says, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of the grapes. So this is really the fourth one, is the picture of the landowner, which is also a picture of Judah. Picture of overflowing with blessing and abundance. And the whole idea is like, you know, it says there, he'll bind his donkey to the vine, you know. There'll be so much vine that he'll just bind his donkey to the vine. You know, it's a picture of abundance. There'll be so much for him. It's a picture of prosperity in that. Overflowing blessings. Verse 12. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth are whiter than milk. So Judah, if you look at Judah as a people, they will be a delivered people. Then verse 13. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships. His borders shall adjoin Sidon. So now, eventually, Zebulun will receive the inheritance in the north, sort of the areas called Lebanon, but they never took their full portion. They never went in completely. And so Zebulun, in this sense, will be an exiled people. Then verse 14, Issachar is a strong donkey. It's like, thanks, Dad. You know, as he's standing there like, you're a strong donkey, my son. You know, it's like, but in those days, you know, donkeys were great. It was like, you know, having a Merc. It's like, it was a great thing if you had a donkey, you know, it was really great. So, but he says, Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. So he's as strong as an ox, but he's lazy, man, you know. He's lying down between the burdens, you know. It's like a large tribe. So Issachar will be a large tribe, but a lazy tribe. It says there, as he continues, he says, he saw the rest was good, and he saw that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. So that was the result of that, you know, that they were exploited. And so Issachar will be an exploited people. Then verse 16, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. So Dan really means judge. And again, they inherit the northernmost part of the base, right there by the base of Mount Hermon in Israel, between Lebanon and the Golan Heights. And so they would be, the thing would turn around really in the sense of he would judge his people. We know that, you know, that up there is Tal Dan and that kind of thing up there. Then verse 17, Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels, so his rider shall fall backward. So, you know, we see here that Dan will be a poisoned people because they introduced idolatry. Dan was the tribe through which idolatry was introduced into the nation of Israel. You remember that time, you know, Balaam and Balak. And so Dan is the tribe that brought it into Israel. And for that reason, they were poisoned people. And then in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of speaking to his sons, this is amazing. Jacob says, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. And so if you just read it like that, you may think like, what does it mean? Well, first of all, this is the first mention of salvation in the scripture, in the Bible. But if you read it, like it says there in the original Hebrew, salvation, O Lord, you would read the words Yahweh Yeshua. That's actually amazing. So he's basically saying, I have waited for Jesus. Right in the first book of the Bible, right in Genesis, in the middle of declaring the blessing where Israel is coming, he's like saying, you know, I have waited for Jesus. Speaking of the Messiah that would come and deliver. Then verse 19, Gad, which we know means a troop comes, but he says, Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. So the foreign armies would come in, they oppress Gad in Jeremiah 49 verse 1. And they also received part of the inheritance outside the land of Canaan. They were on the other side with Reuben. And so Gad will be a persecuted people. Then verse 20, bread from Asher shall be rich and he shall yield royal dainties. So in the sense that it's given there, it's not just necessities that will come to him, but luxuries. Asher will be a protected people and they will be super blessed with in luxury. Verse 21, Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. So Naphtali got the area near the Sea of Galilee. That's really the region where Jesus did much of his preaching and his teaching. And so it's interesting that Naphtali is a deer and he uses beautiful words. So Naphtali will be a preaching people because that's really where Jesus had his preaching and his teaching ministry, most of it. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. So you can just see this picture. Fruitful bough, and then he repeats it, by a well. And you know what? He's so fruitful that his branches hang over the walls. That's how fruitful he is. It's like just an excessive picture, really. And that's a picture of Jesus, because just like Joseph was separated, set apart from his brothers, the same way Jesus was set apart, and also Jesus is that big blessing, being blessed and becoming a huge blessing to others, because we also know that through Jesus we have the biggest blessing. It also says there in verse 23, and the reason why he speaks here of Joseph is just because Joseph all the way through is a picture of Jesus Christ. And so he says in verse 23, the archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. And so that's the arrows that were shot at him, arrows of hatred and bitterness, speaking not just of Joseph, but ultimately of Jesus. Arrows of envy, of jealousy, of temptation, of lies, everything shot at him. But you know what? Just like Jesus Christ, he didn't strike back. He's a fruitful bough. He's even been grieved bitterly. But then it says, verse 24, but his bow remained in strength, and his arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So he became strong instead of it all. But you know what? What he says very clearly here, the secret of his strength was not in Joseph. The secret of Joseph's strength was in the God of Jacob, the mighty God of Jacob. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessing of the breast and of the womb, the blessing of your father have excelled the blessing of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who is separated from his brothers. So, you know, all you read here is just the blessing. In every single area he will be blessed. And this was from the beginning. And that's why, although the line of the Messiah is going to come through Judah, like I said, Joseph is a picture of the Messiah all through. He's a picture of Jesus Christ. So there's just blessing in everything that you can think of, every area. And for us, it means the same thing. If we are in Jesus Christ, you know, there is that fulfillment in him, that blessing in him. Then verse 27, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. So Benjamin was a tribe with a reputation of fierceness. You think about the Benjamites in the scripture. It says, in the morning he shall devour the prey, at night he shall divide the spoil. So Benjamin was one of the toughest tribes in Israel. They were some of the greatest fighters in Israel. They were almost eliminated one time, you know, because they were just fighting and everyone went fighting against them. But from Benjamin, think about it, they came the first king, although he wasn't a great king, it was the first king that came from. And also, the Apostle Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And I mean, he was one tough guy. You know, he could just hang on and just able to endure far behind what is natural, you know. So that's the blessing, or the prophecy is really speaking about the tribe of Benjamin here, because they will be fierce and they will be fighters. They will be tough. And so Benjamin shall be a victorious remnant. Then verse 28, and all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. And I think this is maybe something also to make us think, because besides the fact this is the first time that the 12 tribes of Israel is mentioned in Scripture, this is the first time they're not called the sons, but they are really focusing on the tribes that they're going to become one day, because already they've been growing a lot of people at this stage. But now, you know, think about at the end of his life, he's blessing them according to the things that they've really done in their life. It's almost a picture to us, reminding of what's going to happen to us one day as we stand before the judgment seat of Christ. You know, we'll be blessed according to the things that we have done in this body, like we spoke about on Sunday, the things we've done with a true motivation of heart, a pure heart, the right motive, all those kind of things. And so I'm thinking, like, this is a great thing if a father blesses his children, right, before he passes away. And this is a great thing. And so what we see here is, I'm thinking, like, you know, what would someone say of me at the end of my life, you know, or at that stage of my life? What would become, you know? And so this is, he's speaking prophetically, obviously, by the Lord. But I think it's also important just to consider that. But these are the 12 tribes. And so they're all blessed according to their own blessing, their own calling, their own destiny. Verse 29. And then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. And so now he reminds them of the fact that he really wants to be buried in Canaan, because Canaan was the land of promise. He could have probably, because of his status, because he was an important man, we're just going to see in a moment how much the Egyptians even valued him. He was considered an important man, so he could have had like a decent tomb with like a mummy in a coffin kind of thing. You know, he could have had like a royal kind of thing like that. But he's like, I would rather be buried in an insignificant cave, because, you know, that's in the land of promise. That is the, and so basically he's still speaking about his faith, because he's doing this in faith. I have to be buried in the promised land, because that's the land that God gave to us. Verse 31, he says, there they buried Abram and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. This is quite interesting to me too, that Jacob, at the end of his life, he would be buried with Leah. He wouldn't be buried with Rachel. She was buried on the way, remember? And so now he, at the end of his life, he will be buried in this tomb. That's, you know, that's in Hebron, pretty much, this area of Machpelah. And, you know, I think according to the Jewish customs, you know, like even Adam and Eve were buried there, kind of thing. You know, it's like, according to them, everyone's buried there. But so we know that the patriarchs were buried there. And he says, like, together there with Leah. Verse 32. The field and the cave that is where they purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet into his bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. And so this is the only land that really was purchased. We're going to look at it at the moment too. The only land that that he really paid for. But then he breathed his last, you know. That was the end of the patriarchs. So in one sense, you know, like I said, it can almost be like a very negative thing. But now, like you said, but God was with them. And then we see the last chapter there, chapter 50, is really Jacob's burial and Joseph's death. And so, verse 1, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. So it's very dramatic and very descriptive, you know. He fell on his face. I love the way that he just puts it because it just shows all that emotion and everything that is in there. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. I mean, they were in Egypt after all. You know, they had this amazing methods that they did this. And so it was all to his disposal. And 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptian mourned for him 70 days. Now that was like just about the time that traditionally mourned for a really important person. So the whole country saw Jacob as a really important person. We spoke about it last week that he was the one who actually spoke a blessing over Pharaoh. It says in verse 4, now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. So now Joseph is just sort of giving the word through that this is something that I promised my dad. It's not something I can get out of. I made an oath, and you know, we don't want to run away now or anything like that. You know, I'll still be here, but we really have to go do this. But the interesting thing I found, it says like, in my own grave, which I dug. And so you can say like, what does it mean by that? Because he was buried in a cave. Because in the caves, they would dig these holes in the sides of the cave where they would put the bodies. And so it's not in the ground that he dug it, but they dug these holes in the sides. So they put the bodies in like that. And so he did dig a grave himself. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. So Pharaoh was goodwill towards him. And so Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. So you can just imagine, he was a serious important man. It's like the whole Egypt, all the whole full elders, they all pack up and go with this procession all the way. It's like such a far way to go. I think it's quite a mission. You know, I like what Pastor Chuck also said. Pastor Chuck said, you know, they made this big journey all the way. You know, it's like, if you think about it, it's just the body. The moment you move out of the body, it's the old tent. That's no longer the person. And so now they made this big deal, but because I think it's significant for him that he would be buried in the land of promise. And so it says in verse 8, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house, only the little ones, their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. So this was a big, big gathering that went up. And they went up with him and the chariots and the horsemen, and it was a great gathering. So, you know, you can imagine this dramatic burial. They're going all the way back, all of them, to the land of Canaan. Verse 10, and then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. So this was a huge thing. You know, this thing is not something that just happened. And where they went over, the threshing floor of Atad is very near where Joshua crossed in the area of Jericho. And so they mourned for 7 days. Verse 11. And when inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. They were probably like wondering, what's the Egyptians doing here, you know? What's going on? Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which beyond the Jordan. So it just means a deep mourning, you know? And so his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. So they were obedient to their father. In respect to their father, they did exactly what he asked them. And so by faith, really, Jacob desired to be buried in the promised land because it's the land that God gave them, and they carried out his wishes. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan. They buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. So like I said, this field, the cave in Machpelah, this is the only place that Abram actually purchased. They were sojourners. They didn't purchase anything, but this is an important piece of property, Genesis 23, verse 9. It's also the only part of the land of Canaan that Abram held a deed to in Genesis 23, verse 17. And so then, after all this was done, this big mourning, they all went back. And so Joseph did exactly like he said. They returned to Egypt. And now we see something interesting unfold. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for the evil which we did to him." I mean, how many years later was this? This was such a long time later. You know, and they're still thinking like, well, you know, maybe now he's going to turn on us because dad's no longer there to sort of just like, you know. And so they were worried about this. And I think it's sad because obviously they didn't know anything about their brother. They didn't understand him at all. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." So first of all, they sent messages to him, very official. They didn't really go to him themselves. And then they still had this guilt on them. They still didn't feel forgiven. And so just because they didn't understand who Joseph was, and they're like, "Please, please forgive us," you know. And they make up the story because I don't think this was the truth. They're like, I mean, Joseph was with his father at his deathbed. He was the last there. So if his father said something like this, he would have said it to Joseph. "Joseph, you know, just for you, give your brothers, please." So they make up the story because they're wondering. And the thing is, Joseph doesn't go like, "What are you guys doing?" Joseph, he weeps because he's like, "Don't you understand anything about me?" It's like, "My heart towards you is not a bad heart. I don't dislike you. I don't have anything against you. I've forgiven you a long time ago." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him because to him it was just a sign of the fact that they didn't know who he was. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." So even till this time, they bowed down to him so many times and they still do this because they were worried now. And Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" This is very important because showing here the right estimate of things. You know, judgment, the Bible tells us, belongs to God. Romans 12 verse 19 says, "Beloved, do not avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath, for it's written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." So Joseph's looking at them like, "This is not my place. Why are you talking to me about that? Am I in the place of God?" No. Not at all. "But as for you, you meant evil against me." Sure, you know. "But God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive." And what I like about that, you know, first of all, it's a picture of Jesus because it's a picture of grace. It's a picture of love. Think about us in the context of Jesus. None of us deserve anything. None of us deserve to be saved. None of us deserve any goodwill. We only deserve bad. You know, if you're considered lucky, you deserve a little mercy. You can get some mercy. But now he gives grace. You know, he totally just, he just gives them grace. He says, "God meant it for good." Like, yes, sure, you guys didn't know what you were doing. You were meaning it for evil. You were against me. You know what? That's all old cows in the past, you know. So let's put it behind us. Because it's just grace and it's just love. It's a picture of Jesus Christ. And he says, "Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. This is so cool. Because he's the one that's been wronged. And what he says is like, you know what? That's fine. There's nothing to be worried about. God's done amazing work in Joseph over these years. But also because he's a picture of Jesus Christ. And so Jesus is going to say the same thing one day. Remember, Israel is going to look on him whom they pierced, and they're not going to believe the fact that they did that. And they're going to weep and they're going to mourn. And he's going to say, "Don't worry, I love you." You know, and it's the same thing here. We see the picture of grace and love. And then we read about the death of Joseph after all of this. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, him and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And so the hardship of his life didn't diminish God's blessing on him. Sometimes God makes us strong for a purpose, for a reason. You know, sometimes you look back at your life, we can never see the point of it in the moment. We look back at hardships in that moment when it's hard. We're just like, "Lord, what's going on? Lord, take me out of this. Lord, help," you know, and we just want to get out of it. But many years pass, and you look back and you see, man, God has been so faithful. I would have never understood that. I would have never been there. I would have never been this close to God. God could never do this great deliverance through me, you know, if he didn't allow these things to take place in my life. And so all this hardship didn't diminish God's ultimate blessing in his life. So Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And so here you already see that Ephraim, you know, is children to the third generation. So he's already, the blessing is already sort of beginning. And then he saw even Manasseh's little kid that was brought up on his knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I'm dying, but God. Again, we see those words. Yes, I'm not going to be here anymore, but God. And that's the thing I want to comfort you with and I want to encourage you with. Because, you know, many things may not go as we want them to go. But Joseph said, but God. And those words will stand for eternity. But God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So, I'm just a man, is what Joseph is saying. You know, God used me for a great deliverance, but now my time is up. Now I'm going home. But God is still on the throne. God still knows exactly what he wants to continue doing in you as a nation. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So now he's prophesying. So the promise continues, and now he continues on with that, and he takes an oath from them, from the rest of the tribes of Israel. Because we know when the Israelites left on the Exodus, they took Joseph's bones with them, Exodus 13, verse 19. So this is something that will come to pass in the next book that we're going to probably be into. And Joseph was just like his father and just like the patriarchs. Although he was not a patriarch, he was a man of faith. He's also mentioned in Hebrews 11, 22. It says, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. And see, every time you speak in faith, in this sense, knowing who God is, knowing what God already said, you're just confirming it. Yes, Lord. You know, I can't see it. It's in the future. I'm passing away. But I know that God's going to visit you. He's going to bring you back to that land because that was his promise. And so, sure, we sorrow. Sure, it's a hard thing when someone passes away. But you know what? Like I said, it's not about this body. It's a tent. Like we said on Sunday, it's going to be about the resurrection body, the new body that we spoke about on Sunday. And so what, the moment the spirit's person leaves his body, we don't really relate to the body anymore. We relate to the person because we are not this body. We just use this body for this time. But now, the thing that lies ahead for us is the resurrection body. It's going to be glorious. It's going to be amazing. Verse 26. So Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So obviously he didn't stay in the coffin in Egypt. He was like all mummy galore, you know. But then they didn't leave him there because they took him with them. So it's interesting because now you would find, if you would find this cave and you know everything, you would find some mummies in the land of Israel. It would be interesting, you know, because they would be carried over there. And so that's like more than 300 years later that we're talking about. But just looking at all that we've been speaking about lately, this verse is just repeating in my mind, and it's like Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. The thing is, it's up for us to trust God in faith. All things. All things is all things. It's a lot. It includes everything in the Christian life. If you know that God's on the throne, and I know you do, if you believe that he loves you and he's got a best plan for you, then whatever you find yourself in, your circumstances, your situation, your trials, your tribulation, that's part of all things. God knows it. And if you allow him, he will work it out together for good. And one day you'll look back and you'll say, man, I'm so thankful, you know, that God did that in my life.